Welcome to Bridging the Gap. We are Alaskans discussing issues that divide us in order to find solutions that will unite us. Welcome to Bridging the Gap. Today is the 22nd in a series of panel discussions of Alaskans examining issues that divide us politically in these turbulent times. My name is Paul Thomas. I live in Trapper Creek. The objective of the panel discussion is to derive through questions posed to the participants an understanding of the causes that have resulted in the current polarization of American political discourse. Subsequent to achieving a satisfactory understanding of the causes, it is hoped that through further discussion, a strategy for positive interaction can be constructed, which can achieve a respectful accommodation of each side towards the other. Today, we're going to be talking about racism. And with us are some very familiar voices, Mike Molesky, Charles Hayes, and Judy Getty. Now, the first question that I have to the panel here goes way back in the past, back in 1955. Anyone here know who Emmett Till is?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Right.
Why don't you give us, share with us a little bit what you know. Start with you, Charles. What do you know about Emmett Till?
He was accused of harassing her or something, a white woman, and he was killed.
Flirting.
He was a young teenage black boy just down south visiting family.
He was from Chicago originally, visiting his family down in Mississippi.
And got accused of that flirting and was lynched or killed.
Well, yeah, actually, there was a report that he was lynched, but he was actually beaten in the face and then shot in the head. And the significance of Emmett Till, Mike, you have anything to add about what we've talked about so far about Emmett?
Well, I put it more in context. I'm thinking that you gave a date. And anything that we discuss, I think, when we're talking about racism, has two aspects. One, some changes that have happened because time has moved on. And then an underlayment that suggests that nothing has changed. And I think at that point in 1955, there were differences about what a non-white person could do in the South, and that has changed. But the underlying issues still remain. That would be my response.
Okay. Well, one of the things I wanted to get out here about our early discussion on Emmett Till was that after he was beaten, basically pistol whipped, and his head was all swollen and everything, he was sent back to Chicago for his funeral, and his mother made a determination that she was going to have an open casket. Right. And his picture laying in the casket was one of, you know, monstrous, okay, grotesque, and that went all over the newspapers of, in America, primarily the black papers. And another thing that was significant in regard to that was after it became so permeating through the society, through the media at that time, was Rosa Parks, who refused to give up her seat at the front of the bus to move to the back of the bus, was arrested, and all she could say was, the only thing I could think about was Emmett Till. So many historians attribute the story of Emmett Till as the start of the civil rights movement. There have been many examples of resistance to civil rights. There are the lynchings, Bull Connor, the fire hoses of the police dogs. There were a lot of church bombings. Of course, the George Wallace, the politician, police shootings, etc. But I can't think of anything more successful as far as the resistance to civil rights than Donald Trump's four-year campaign of lies about President Barack Obama's citizenship. He finagled that consistent, outright lie into becoming President of the United States. Am I overstating the significance of the birther movement in catapulting Trump to power?
I don't think so. Not at all.
And I don't want to think of him having that much power. I think, you know, kind of like what Mike said, when we look at this contextually and historically, we have to think in terms of the variety of things that have made racism prevalent in our society. And I think what Donald Trump did was just tap into that And I think part of what we're going to be talking about today is white privilege, and so how people who want to exploit that can, and that that racism is alive and well in the United States. And I think that he just tapped into something that was there.
I like Judy's answer. I think that sometimes, and we were continuing to have this discussion, there's an event that happens or an individual that appears on the scene, and they become a catalyst for other people to act, for other people to talk about the issue. I think I would place, particularly before he became president, Donald Trump as one of a number of people who were doing what they were doing. I think the danger.
So we can look at David Duke as an example.
Well, sure.
A number of people, but David Duke wasn't successful. Donald Trump was highly successful.
Well, then I would ask you to tell me more about what you mean by he was highly successful in what he did, perpetuating a myth of a birther controversy. What did he do, and why was he successful?
He ran for president and won.
But was it because of the birther issue? I think your original question is asking, was that the most significant way in which he managed to ascend to the presidency? I would submit that it's more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The most significant part as far as catapulting him into the presidency by solidifying a base that went with that.
Well, hatred is a great unifier. You can really bring people together around hatred.
And mix in fear with that.
Yeah. I'm 75 years old. I grew up in Texas and Oklahoma in the 40s and 50s. Racism back then was the order of the day. The N-word was as common as good morning or good afternoon. I was on the wrong side of the civil rights era.
In the locale that you were in?
In the locale, okay. I was in. And I have been writing books and essays for more than 30 years about the subject of self-education. And a big impetus for my doing that is to make up for being on the wrong side. I realized how wrong I was, and I have been trying to shed light, to where people who were in that kind of position can do the same thing. I mean, that I did.
You were shaking your head earlier. What was your thought?
Well, I think it was around the most difficult question of all, that looking back at a sequence that shows, say, in this case, Donald Trump began throwing out his comments about the birther issue, and then noting that he was elected president. And then in the process, since we're talking about racism, we're focused on perhaps that aspect. But if I take the time to stop a bit, roll back, and put myself back in those years and look at all the other things that he was doing, or for that matter, what other people were doing, then it becomes more complex. And I would submit that the birther piece, to tease that out, you would probably have to do a survey of his supporters, blind survey, saying what of all the things that Donald Trump has said he would do, that he had presented to you, were the most significant ones. I haven't seen that come out telling me that, yes, because I'm trying to put myself in the mind of someone who is a true believer and is doing that, and I have trouble with that. So I need more information, but from my own standpoint, but it may be because I didn't think that the birther issue was an issue. But Judy, any?
And I kind of see what you're saying, Paul, because I think that he was playing to a base. And I think he's a member of that base. And so it's not like he has to get inside their heads, kind of like what you're trying to do. he knows how they think. And it's about white privilege, and it's about maintaining that white privilege and playing to the hatred, playing to the fear, to keep that in-group as close as possible to him.
Do racists believe that they are racists or that there is anything wrong with racism?
Well, there's implicit racism and explicit racism. Explicit racism is just being a racist, period. Implicit is just picking up on reality. I mean, our brains are bias organs. That's what they do. They work 24/7 to nail reality. They don't try to record what we should think. They record what is. I mean, I use an example of a little white girl and her mother seeing a little black toddler, and she says, "Oh, look, mommy, a baby maid." I mean, if whatever is real, our brain records as real, and it picks it up as an implicit reality, and intuitively we are drawn towards that when we make a decision. That's the reason it takes generations and 300 years. I mean, we had 250 years of slavery, 90 years of Jim Crow, 60 years of separate equal, and 35 years of sanctioned redlining. All that stuff, the reality has to change before people start recording the reality and coming up with different assumptions.
So, Paul, I'm curious. I've been listening carefully to Charles here, and I'm wondering if, as we look at racism, we're talking about one facet of a thing that we've had other discussions that have focused on the other quality. So if someone happens to be Catholic or Protestant or Jewish or Muslim, that's not a racial thing.
It's otherness.
It's otherness, right.
Otherness. Race, uncertainty, change. All those things are cousins to mortality, and people are afraid of them. I mean, conservatism, liberals are primarily open to experience, and conservatives are much less so. I mean, it's more fear-based. I knew when Barack Obama was elected president that there was going to be a backlash. I underestimated how bad it was. And what Trump did on that birther issue, just pick up on it and run with it.
So I think to get back to, because if you use the word racist, I don't think anybody's going to jump up and say, "Oh man, yeah, I'm a racist," because of course that's a bad word, right? But they may engage in racist acts because, but they're not going to call themselves racist because it's like saying, "Here's the thing: if I'm truly racist, it's not that I'm picking on some other race; it's that I happen to know that the white race is better, and that's a fact." And so if they're coming from that, then it's not necessarily, this ugly term that's applied to it. It's just if people understood that the white race was better.
So can you say that objectively they are racists, but refusing to admit?
Right. And I think, when Charles was talking about the implicit, here, I'll give you an example. I teach psychology, and so I often encourage students, or it can be an assignment, that they go on to the implicit associations test that Harvard University has online. And you can do it with regards to race. You can do it with regards to religion. You can do it gender. You can do many different old and young, different categories of people. And so they take this test, and they don't like the results. They don't like that it turns out they have a high preference for some group that's probably a group that they belong to. Yeah. And so they start picking apart what's wrong with the test, about how it's administered or what they had to do. They do not like to see themselves as a person who has these implicit associations that make one group preferable to another.
Doesn't it still all boil down to group hierarchies? Like, don't some white people need to feel superior to Afros or Hispanics in order to buttress their prestige in the group of American citizens?
Well, that plays a part in it, but it's, to me, it's primarily about categorization. I'm working on a book about called My Blue Bias, A Former Cop Rethinks Policing and Deadly Force. I was on the Dallas Police Department for 4 years in the 60s, and I've been reflecting on that experience for more than 50 years. What I hope to do is make a good argument to help keep unarmed black men from being shot. And that comes back to the implicit bias aspect, because you don't have to be a racist to see a black man and to categorize him as different implicitly. If you're paying attention to contemporary culture, you have to observe that black men are more dangerous than white men. If you go over our movies and our books and our news and all that stuff,
I have a story from 1959, and it's a kind of another aspect of this. At that point, I'd finished a freshman year at a university, and I was going off. We were going to live in a house, we being a group of people. There were a couple of people, because the university I attended had some black students, and we were going to go look at a place that was big enough to hold all of us. And I remember clearly, it sort of burned into my mind, where the black guy said, maybe you should go, because they recognized the probability of a bias if they went, or that's what they understood. And this is back in 1959, way before civil rights actions happened, et cetera. But I remember my own feeling at the time saying, whoa, I had not understood that the same way they did. Now, they were in my classes, I knew them, played ball together, whatever kinds of things we did. But it wasn't at least at the forefront of my consciousness, but it very much was from there. So I submit that maybe as an example that in any given circumstance, depending upon who you are, where you are, if you happen to be in a minority, for example, and you're living in a village in Alaska, and the majority of population is Native, you may feel something that is not felt as any kind of racial animosity by the majority population.
This is Bridging the Gap on KVRF Radio Free Palmer, Big Cabbage Radio. Today we're talking about racism with Judy Getty, Charles Hayes, and Mike Molesky. Last episode we had on sexual orientation, our panelists was Pat Chesbro, Lisa Boyles, and Sarah Welton. They talked about how the other is viewed by certain population segments or demographics. I think it was Sarah who spoke about the fear of the other. And we discussed the need to maintain the semblance of superiority over the other. And Pat Chesbro brought in some research that shows a disgust of the other. So we came up on that show with three emotional expressions: fear, superiority, or condescension, and disgust of people not like us. Charles, you already mentioned hatred. Okay. Are there any other views that you think might lead a group to consider others in a bigoted way besides what we talked about?
Misogyny and racism are related because of slavery and our history. But if you can categorize somebody as being disgusting, you have already won or lost the argument, because we primarily became used disgust to keep from being poisoned or eating the wrong thing, but metaphorically we can get to the same place in the brain for disgust as that poison or being sick because you ate too much of something. You know, you eat a particular food and it makes you sick and you can't eat it again maybe for the rest of your life. This you can get the same place in an area of disgust in the brain.
So, and you can see the connection there too, because I think, you know, to look at another culture or group of people and feel disgust, you have to have some sense of superiority. So the thing that I was thinking about with that is that, you know, oftentimes with foods, we'll think, you know, that it's disgusting so that some other culture will eat a particular food. And then I think that kicks in that sense that my culture is superior, because of course we wouldn't, you know, condescend to doing such a thing.
So I'm curious, because in mentioning the present circumstance in the United States and looking at the president and before he was elected and now, perhaps his attitudes toward people of different races, whether there's a sense that we're moving in the direction of a kind of institutionalized racism. And of course, the classic example of that is to look at a place like Germany. And look at Germany in the 20s, and then as Hitler comes to power in the 30s, and the development of a very real program, process for institutionalized racism, not only to Jews as a considered to be a race, but to the Slavic races that were considered different than the Aryan race itself. I think when I start thinking about the racism which has been allowed to perhaps or have been fanned into flaring up, that's what I wonder if there is enough of an inherent other reaction in the United States to cause an institutionalization.
The whole world is upset because of otherness. Brexit is because of otherness. I knew when the Berlin Wall came down that other people would start putting it up when there was too many people crossing borders. The thing from Syria, I mean, and all over Europe. I mean, that's the major crux is otherness.
Is the Muslim ban motivated by religion or race or something else?
Back to otherness.
I think that since the focus of our topic is racism, what I'm realizing as we're talking that I'm having trouble pinning a lot of what is happening in the present world on racism. I'm being drawn along to what Charles has suggested in otherness. But without losing the focus, I'm saying I believe that racism is a facet. It's part of the whole story of why and how people react to someone who is other than them. But it becomes easy to. I think the racial thing plays in because it's easy for me to look at someone and make a guess. I may be wrong, but to say this is a Native American. This person happens to be black. This person here is Hispanic, this person, and so on. I make those guesses, and I feel myself that I could probably get close to being accurate. Many of the other things, your religious orientation, unless it's accompanied by a particular dress, is a little more difficult to pin down.
We've only learned for about 20 years that we are biologically predisposed to be against too much otherness. Oxytocin and vasopressin in our brain are bonding chemicals. And oxytocin brings us closer together. But at some point, for conservatives and liberals too, oxytocin will take you the other way if you push too far in the otherness respect. I mean, it's so how do you and that never comes up. We don't ever talk about that. We don't ever deal with
it. We talk about it every time you're on the show.
Okay. but it's not public conversation. I mean, it's an open secret.
I think the other piece of that too, and I don't know if we've used the power word here, but I think that people in power want what's familiar and want, you know, that they not lose their power, thinking of power in kind of finite terms, and there's only so much of it. And if these other groups come in, somehow I have to share that limited amount of power. And so it's just better to keep others away from my power.
See, I think the whole thing is explained through the model of group hierarchies. I just see the whole thing unfolding, the dynamic of it. You know, how does Trump come to power? How did Obama come to power? And it's the same thing. You know, the alpha of the group is the one that's going to take it. And if that group ends up succeeding, whether the group is Democrats, Republicans, or Americans, like right now we're in a battle with the Americans and the Russians. You know, who's going to be on top? Anyway, the biggest issue in my mind so far in this young Trump presidency is the zero-tolerance immigration policy that has separated little kids from their parents. Is that all nationalistic, or is there a racial component to that policy?
Well, I think he made that clear when he said he didn't want people from those S-hole countries. Yeah, why can't we get more people from Norway? Mm-hmm. I think he made it very clear, you know, this merit-based system, this idea that somehow, you know, people of Caucasian descent would be, you know, more meritorious and deserving of being in this country. So I think that his view on immigration is clearly a
I would
racist.
Say that he has racism in his bone marrow. I mean, he has to literally undo everything President Obama did. I mean, he's obsessed with doing that. And that has, to me, there's a racist underpinning to that.
Well, even if there were not an underpinning of racism, I think just on the basis of Obama having moved a lot of policies along, he would want to undo those. I think racism in this case is perhaps in his bones, but I think it's a fellow traveler. I think far more significant to him is wanting to be seen as the best. He states it over and over again, I am the best, even in circumstances where really it's difficult to substantiate that. And coming after a president who, although somewhat controversial in some aspects, certainly had achievements, and to roll those back is a way of coming out on top. The fact that Obama's black, yeah, that's thrown in and carried along there. I personally see that there are stronger forces at work within the president than being able to tease out the vein that's racism. And what I'm curious,
maybe narcissism is more prominent with Trump than racism.
Yeah, think of those countries that have had a homogeneity of population characteristics. One that is obvious is Japan. You know, Japan has a very homogeneous population. There are some other people who live in and marry Japanese and so on, but it's a pretty homogeneous population, both culturally and racially, if you will. And at one point in the history of Japan, they had an attitude which might well be termed racist toward the rest of the world. They felt put down by, and in fact, we responded nicely by looking at Japan back in the 20s and 30s as being inferior, etc., in many ways. And so I'm wondering, you know, when we talk about this, we're talking from the context of the United States. It's a big melting pot. I mean, we have huge numbers of people who have managed to intermarry, etc. So it's hard sometimes to, you know, fill out the form that says, well, what are you? Well, I am this, 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 and that. That process of assimilation and blending has been going on for some years, even with all that we're saying about the other quality. So it's hard now to identify someone as Hispanic if they've been married and their grandparents, etc., have married to a Polish guy. And after a while, you say, well, what are you, in that sense?
One of the things that experiences that I had, and Judy, you probably share this, working in the prisons for 20 years, I worked in the prison in Pennsylvania, and it seemed to me in those places, and there was no like skinhead movement or anything, or any black power movement. All the races got along in prison. It just seemed like the melting pot was completely exemplified by the ways that people got along. They looked at each other as individuals, and they were fellow inmates, and they were in the same boat, and the skin color had very little to do with who they got along with. Was that your experience, Judy?
I often think of the years that I worked in corrections up here, which were 1984 to 2004, as a time when our prison population, and I use the word unsophisticated, because your point about that they mix very well together is accurate. I think what we were just starting to see in the late 90s, and we were starting to keep track of it, was gang affiliations. So we were starting to see some of that. There were Southeast Asian gangs. And I'm not so sure if that's still the experience now, you know, 14 years later after I've left the department. I think that there's some of that racism that's coming with individuals who have had experiences in other places, and they bring that with them.
You think it's encroaching back into the prison system and the population?
I think so, yeah.
For years, outrageous racial remarks were condemned as by political correctness, as some may characterize common decency. We didn't try to insult people by calling them the N-word. So Republicans, and this is my observation, were using dog whistles to get their racially bigoted supporters to get behind them. Words like, phrases like welfare queens, calling President Obama lazy, Congresswoman Maxine Waters low IQ. Those are examples of dog whistles. Are we past that point where the racists need to disguise their bigotry? Has the Trump presidency opened the gates to outright expressions of racial animosity?
He set us back 20 years. He really has. When hatefulness wins elections, hatefulness becomes more popular. And it's all of a sudden people are saying things now that they would have not said 5 years ago.
They feel more comfortable being insulting to other people's races.
No, contraire. I think there may be that wave. But there are also individual examples this past week of people who have been CEOs of corporations that happen to use a N-word, and they're no longer there.
Talking about Papa John.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm not certain that this is a wave that has been a tsunami that has done everything. What I believe is happening is that there's more awareness and attention paid, in part because of the advance of social media, so that if somebody had said something somewhere, that might not have filtered out into the world. Now, as soon as it's said, the echo is coming, and it's echoing everywhere. So then it becomes something that is known and is much easier for people to say, wait a second, and that kind of public response is bothersome to boards of directors, et cetera.
But the only person that's going to be punished like that is somebody that's got a lot of visibility.
Sure.
All these millions of people out here that are just working, consider themselves working stiffs, don't have to abide by that.
I'd only submit that I'll take any victory.
The what?
I'll take any victory around that. It doesn't matter whether it's big or small.
Well, yeah. Well, look at the Me Too movement. I mean, that's terrific on one hand, but on the other, I think things are probably not getting all that much better in that respect, as far as average citizens, too.
Is accountability being injected into the process by this type of discussion, or is less accountability? Mike seems to think that there's more because of the Papa John thing.
I think there are instances of it, but I'm really interested in what Judy is going to say about the Me Too movement. That comment that Charles made.
Well, and maybe this will address part of it, but as you were talking, I was thinking that, you know, my concern was the phrase political correctness was getting thrown in, and that, we can finally give up being politically correct. And I thought, if you substitute the phrase civil or kind.
Common decency is what
I use. Polite, yeah, common decency. If you use any of those other words or phrases, then it has a different meaning. And I think that goes with, if we're talking about racist things, or if we're talking about misogyny or any of those things, that the idea that somehow now we have free reign and we can use words that, the thought police or the word police were keeping us from using before, and now we won't be held accountable. But so to your answer or question, I think, people high profile are being held accountable, but maybe not those common people. And I think that's where, that it falls on all of us to say, I don't appreciate that.
Is it because
that's not
they
okay.
got caught? Is it because they got caught?
The most politically correct time period in my lifetime that I can remember was the 1950s. I mean, if you were to have said something in a part of the country where I grew up in favor of civil rights, you would have been pummeled. I mean,
kind of the flip of it then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but the question is, today or yesterday, did you encounter racism in going through your daily life? And what was your response if you did encounter that? Go back a couple of days if you have to.
For me personally, it was depending on the peer group I functioned in. My peer group in grade school, you know, we were very racist growing up in an all-white community in Western Pennsylvania. And as I got more into high school, it was pretty much the same thing because it was an all-white seminary. But when I got to college, there were a few more blacks on campus, and that's whenever things started to become a little bit more.
What about, though, in the now? Do we have a topic of racism? We were thinking that it is worthy of discussion. So personally, I'm trying to think, having asked the question, have I encountered, been aware of racist activities, not reported, so I'm looking out that the CEO was fired or resigned or whatever, but in my life in Palmer, Alaska, and I am not aware of anything, and that may be because I didn't notice, but I'm curious about the rest of you.
Well, we're all white people sitting here, so of course we have our white privilege. But to get to that, I grew up in North Dakota, and I grew up near an Indian reservation. And so my experience was being around Native Americans. And I never thought of my father as somebody who was prejudiced. But every once in a while, now he's 91, he will say things, and I am appalled, just appalled at what he will say. And it's just because of the years and years and years of living in that community where those sort of things would be said. And so at 91, should I, you know, I'll say things like, that's not very nice, Dad, but how do you admonish, you know, your father? So, yeah, I see it.
One day we were watching TV in the living room with my parents, and my dad said, who is Michael Jackson? This was back in the 80s. Of course, Michael Jackson was the king of pop. And my mother said, oh, he's that N that plays with himself. And my dad goes, oh. And we were sitting there in the room, my wife, myself, my brother, his wife, and we looked at each other and we thought, what can we do at this point to correct this, what my mom said? Because she was so old at the time, and it just seems like generationally, it just didn't seem to make any sense to jump in that. Now, was I wrong for remaining silent whenever this, you know?
It's what their brain tells them. I took the implicit bias to Harvard test. I show a strong preference for white people.
Mm-hmm.
And I have dedicated years to trying to fix this stuff. But and I can compensate. I guess I can compensate. I never shot anybody. That was good, right? But when I was on the police department, we were a racist police department, period. And there is still a whole lot of it all over the country.
Well, I've had the recent experience. I know Judy travels a lot, too, to remote areas of Alaska. And I was recently 2 days in Bethel. And I was struck by, I think, one, I was aware that Bethel has a large Native population. But I was really struck by the range of other people there, from Southeast Asia, from all different places. And, of course, from a religious standpoint, there are many different churches there, but there are two that dominate, Russian Orthodox and a Moravian. And I was thinking to myself, there's a melting pot that is a place that if I were pursuing this question, I'd want to go and spend a longer period of time and observe, spend a little time just being in the community and noticing, are there visible signs that can be picked up about racism? Because I saw a lot of people driving cabs, working different jobs. Of course, we have, because of the nature of corporations, Native corporations in the state, we have Native corporations which have significant power as well by having businesses and so on. And yet we also have a lot of different people that live in Bethel. So I'm thinking about that as my most recent example of a place where I would have thought I would see leaping out at me racism in action, but I didn't. I mean, it didn't. I am thinking about this now, saying, okay, did I miss stuff? What did I miss? And I'm not sure whether it's because of...
Did you expect more racism than you observed?
No.
I don't understand how you're...
The reason why I'm bringing it up is because I'm reflecting upon that experience because we're talking about it right now. I didn't go into the trip to go there because I serve on a board which is made up roughly 40% Native representatives. And I regularly meet with, we have discussions, and I would... If I were describing the people, I would probably describe them in some sense by maybe some of their accomplishments or what they do, but I wouldn't describe them as the you pick from wherever, you know, that because I know them in the context of how I relate to them and their personality. This person is a teacher in a village, for example. So I'm thinking, am I different? Have I lost sensitivity to this? And I think this is the important thing. If there's a listener here saying, okay, where do you fit in this spectrum of having implicit within you some form of a racist bias that only bubbles up when you're under pressure?
My biggest fear is overcompensating. To feel, okay, I'm interacting with a black person here. Do I agree with that person because they have had these discriminatory practices against them in the past, or am I going to actually agree or disagree based on the merits of their position rather than them? So that's kind of like my fear. I don't want to, you know, overcompensate and just say, okay, you're black, so we're friends just because you're black. No.
To me, a significant cure for this, and it's not a cure-all, but when we stopped truly, truly valuing a liberal education and we educate human doings and not human beings. We lost out. I mean, anthropology shouldn't be. I mean, if you don't learn about all people, you can't put your own people into perspective. I mean, we need a broad education, and it's losing ground every year. I mean.
And I think part of that is just being able and willing to listen and think that because of this person's other experiences, their life has been different than mine, and to realize that they came to whatever position that they have based on, you know, those experiences, and, you know, and that includes the color of their skin and, you know, the other things that we've talked about, their religious background, their gender, their orientation, all of those things are going to color their perspective. And so, you know, I just try to have an appreciation for that, even if I don't understand, even if I don't agree.
Mm-hmm. Charles and Mike and I all belong to a demographic that I readily admit to being ashamed of my affiliation. That group is old white men. I'm guessing most of us don't do much more than listen to Fox News and hate Obama. We all grew up in the same America in the 50s and 60s, some of us in the 40s. And we all experienced the subsequent decades of the 20th century, now a couple here in the 21st century. What happened? Why are most of the old white men in America today Trump supporters?
Well, first of all, I'd want to ask for the detail of that. I know that if we were to, and the survey seemed to support, that the vast majority of identified Republican white men are Trump supporters. But if we were to turn to two other groups, one, Democratic Party, that is not the case. The majority of white Democratic old white men are not Trump supporters. And it also then one look, of course, at the independent group and say, what's that turn out to be? So I think...
Old white men are Trump supporters?
I don't think globally in the United States, most old white men are not Trump supporters.
I think education is an important factor in that.
Yeah.
The more education that old white men have, the less they are likely to be Trump supporters.
So as the best I can tell, and absent the opportunity to go down and look at all the numbers, demographics that we have, I believe it's accurate to say that a minority of old white men are Trump supporters nationally.
I mean, I'm embarrassed by the statistic of white women who voted for him, and I'm a white woman.
More white women voted for him than for Hillary.
Exactly. And so, you know, I have my embarrassments, too. So, but
I'm embarrassed that I live in a country that he has more than 10% support.
Well, I'm going to focus my embarrassment, since you've all shared here. I'm going to focus my embarrassment a little more directly and say, and I've been thinking about this as we go through these topics. My focus is on me. I'll take a page out of the president's book, but in a different way, I think. And ask, okay, if I see something happening in the country, I can ask, what am I doing myself? And I reject the idea that I'm only one person. I know there are examples after examples of someone who will step forward and do something. Small piece, maybe here, may not be going to Washington and making something big happen that everybody in the country knows about. But I still come down and say, okay, I see a situation, and then I'm saying, what do I do in this particular situation? And I'm thinking there were people in occupied Europe during the Second World War that saw the enormity of the German army occupying France, etc., and that were told, oh, okay, this is pretty bad. And it was. So there were some that said, okay, what can I do, even if it's a small thing? And so that's my sense of this whole thing. It all comes back to the individual.
So we have to look at what is in front of us and see how our actions can be most effective into making it right.
Right. And if there's some aspect of what is being provided by the president as policy changes, there may be some aspect of it that I would want to say, yeah, I want to take that, but I want to take it somewhere other than where it's going. I want to move it in a different direction. But I don't know, for example, that all of the actions recently taken, the tariff issues, that these have an undercurrent of racism. I think he's an equal opportunity offender.
We are Bridging the Gap on KVRF Radio Free Palmer. Today we're discussing racism with Judy Getty, Charles Hayes, and Mike Molesky. Interstate cross-check. Anyone ever hear of interstate cross-check? You know what that is?
Uh-uh.
All right, I'll explain it to you. It is a database used by most of the states to see if voters in their states are also voting in other states. So if my name, Paul Thomas, appears on the voter rolls in Alaska, and it also appears as a registered voter in Pennsylvania, Alaska, which participates in interstate cross-check, could theoretically remove my name from the voter rolls in an effort to stop Paul Thomas from voting in multiple states. I'm not concerned about me because the voter registration deletions from states participating in cross-check are overwhelmingly Black, Hispanic, Asian, Democrats. The Washington Post reported that cross-check's error rate to be around 99%. Ohio alone has purged over 400,000 registrations based on cross-check methods. Is the will of the people a phrase that has meaning anymore?
Well, that's scary. That is scary.
And I think we're hearing more about this, you know, the voter suppression, the variety of ways that they're coming up with to really discourage or make it impossible for people of minority groups to vote. So it is becoming very concerning.
They're not even checking the middle names. If my name's Paul A. Thomas. If Paul T. Thomas, who happened to be Black, showed up as well, then they could just eliminate that. What they were doing in Ohio was they were sending out postcards from the voter registration part. And if you didn't respond to that postcard, which said you need to respond, then they could just go ahead and take you off. Over 400,000 in Ohio.
The great danger of democracy is it offers up the wherewithal to undo it. And that's what we're I'm afraid we're doing.
Affirmative action. It's been around for a long time, since the 70s. Good, bad, how's it worked out?
Mediocre. I mean, it's there's still implicit bias. I mean, you know, how long did we go when it was thought that a black person was only 3/5 of a person? When slavery ended, slavery didn't stop. Right after Reconstruction, they started rounding up black men in the South for walking down the street and charging them with fictitious crimes, and they had another decades of leasing prisoners. I mean, leasing convicts. So the implicit bias that I was talking about, that has to change. I mean, for a long time, people thought that black people couldn't perform in the professions. They couldn't be doctors and lawyers and stuff. They had to be a whole bunch of doctors and lawyers before people would record that. Yeah, that works. I can see that. They're okay. The reality has to change significantly before implicit bias goes away. Because
so is affirmative action a vehicle that is worth pursuing in order to get that change to occur?
I don't think we would have made very much progress at all if we hadn't had some affirmative action. I don't know when we'll get to the point to where we're going to have a serious advance of education if we're ever going to get beyond this.
Most of the affirmative action that was occurring was in the area of education, and all the court cases were with the main universities, Michigan State University or Michigan University.
And I think the idea to, you know, open the doors and level the playing field is a good ideal. And I think that it did offer a number of people opportunities that they would not have had. And I think now that the research that we have that shows that any work setting, any school setting, where you have a mixture of races, where you have a mixture of ages, that those are more full and better experiences and better work comes out of those kinds of groups.
But see, the playing field is not level, and it's not going to be level for a long, long time, because it takes successive generations of successfully economic people in order to lay down a foundation so people can continue to succeed in the future.
So I'm going to let Mike answer this question. Is affirmative action a legitimate way in order to level this playing field that Charles was talking about?
I think affirmative action has had its successes, and it is not perfect in the way it's been applied. It is also very different depending on where you are, whether you're talking about a particular profession or arena or a particular state. I think that's the danger when we look at something like affirmative action and say, well, it good, bad. That's taking all of those examples in, bring them together and saying, okay, somehow can we come up with a summary that says good or bad? I think it was an important step. I think what it also does is facilitate the conversation. You're going to have a continuing conversation. I love it. If someone says, I think affirmative action has worked against me as a non-to-be-affirmed person, then let's have that conversation. How will it work better if we were to change it somewhat?
We have about 5 seconds each here. What do you think we can or should do to curtail the emerging trend of emboldened racial bigotry? Anything that we can do individually?
I think challenge it when we see it.
Okay. Charles?
I'd go for that.
All right.
How better to say it than
yes, right.
Judy?
I want my 5 seconds.
Well, I want to thank Judy, Charles, and Mike for joining us today. And to all you out there in Radio Land, thanks for listening. Thanks for listening to Bridging the Gap. We welcome diversified perspectives. If you are interested in becoming a panelist for a future show, send us an email to manager@radiofreepalmer.org.
This program is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of moderators and guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, the station, or its underwriters.